From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. When it comes to Southwest Florida history, you've probably heard about the contributions of men like Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, or Captain Frances Hendry, but what about the region's influential women? As March marks National Women's History Month, this morning's panel of local experts will highlight some of the well-known and lesser-known women who shaped our region. Plus, the political contest among candidates looking to replace Trey Radel in Congress has been heating up in recent weeks. Despite early talk of a clean campaign, attack ads have emerged from super PACs and from the campaigns of Senator Lisbeth Benequisto, former CEO Kurt Clausen, and former State Representative Paige Kriegel. Ahead of the April 22nd GOP primary, we'll explore this evolving campaign and analyze ads to separate fact from fiction. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. The political climate has shifted since our last look at the special election to replace Trey Radel in representing Florida's 19th congressional district in Lee and Collier counties. Later in today's show, our political analysis team takes a closer look at the race and claims made in campaign ads from GOP candidates Lisbeth Benequisto, Kurt Clausen, and Paige Kriegel. But first, as March marks National Women's History Month, we're exploring notable women in the history of Southwest Florida. You've probably heard of notable historical figures like Harvey Firestone, Thomas Edison, and Henry Ford, but what about the women who've played a significant role in shaping local history? Joining me now for a closer look is president and owner of Fort Myers-based Hanson Real Estate Advisors. He's also a fifth-generation Fort Myers resident and holds the Hanson Family Archives Collection in trust. The archive is a collection of more than 1,000 artifacts, including photos, letters, and other historical documents going back five generations. The archive plays a significant role in efforts to document and preserve the region's history. Woody Hanson, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you, and good morning.
Also returning to the show is writer Jerry Reeves. She's written two books on local history, including Fort Myers, Then and Now, and Legendary Locals of Fort Myers. For nearly 10 years, she's also written a weekly column for the River Weekly News. Jerry Reeves, thanks for being with us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
And we're also talking with writer Tom Hall. You can read his stories covering a broad array from the local art scene online at examiner.com. He's also a guide for a new downtown Fort Myers walking tour from True Tours called Fort Myers Founding Females. Tom Hall, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. If there's a woman in Southwest Florida of historical significance that you think has been overlooked, give us a call. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or post your comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Tom, let's start with you. What can you tell us about the Fort Myers Founding Females walking tour of downtown Fort Myers?
Well, most of the historical accounts that people read or hear about always focus on the men. But it's not hyperbole to say that but for the Fort Myers Founding Females, it's likely there wouldn't be a Fort Myers at all, and certainly not the Fort Myers that we know. Women like Jane L. Hendry, certainly Tootie McGregor, even Flossie Hill, they weren't just women who made their men great. These were great women who did historic things and made significant contributions to the development of downtown Fort Myers. And at True Tours, we decided it's time that their stories be told.
And Tom, as an art writer, how did you get involved in you know, leading these history tours in Fort Myers?
Well, it's a little convoluted. I started out researching public artworks. And what I discovered is that public art is really all about history. And so I became something of a history buff, and it kind of morphed. I did downtown public art tours for True Tours. And when this opportunity became available, I certainly raised my hand and volunteered to take it on.
And I understand you've also linked your connections to the local art world with this effort to highlight significant women in local history. Tell us about that.
I have. That's kind of an exciting endeavor. In addition to doing these walking tours, I've contacted the Portrait and Figure Painter Society and have invited local artists to do renderings of some of these historic women. And that collection of portraits will be exhibited initially at the Linen Cottage in downtown Fort Myers so that as people take the tour, will stop at the Linen Cottage and they can actually put a face with the names that they've been hearing about. We're really excited about that.
How's that effort going so far? How many more artists are you looking to commission?
Well, we ultimately really like to have between 20 and 30 portraits in the exhibition. So far, we probably have about a dozen artists who have expressed an interest, including Leoma Lovegrove, who's going to do a portrait of Mina Edison. We've got Stephen Gray Blanchett, who's going to do Veronica Shoemaker. And Cindy Jane, who is a tremendous surrealist, is volunteered to do Dr. Ella May Piper.
All right. Well, while we're on the subject, let's go ahead and start with Dr. Ella May Piper. Tom, this is someone who's going to be highlighted on the tour. I understand when she first came to Fort Myers, she opened up a beauty shop, but is really kind of more known for her philanthropic work with seniors and young kids.
Precisely. Of course, some of the women might feel that she deserves to be a founding female just because she did open up the first beauty shop in downtown Fort Myers. But you're right. Her work went far, far beyond that. She was a founding member of the black community, which at that time was called Safety Hill. Her mother, Sarah Williams, had done an annual Christmas tree party for the local children for many, many years. And when she died in 1926, Dr. Piper took that over. And because of her stature in the community, civic leaders, churches, businesses, black and white, contributed to make that a success. And that event is still carried on today. But Dr. Piper went on and made many other significant contributions. She helped fund the Dunbar Community School, which for the first time allowed black children from Lee Collier in Charlotte County to get a high school education. Previous to that, they couldn't. She was instrumental in funding the Jones Walker Hospital, which was the first hospital for non-whites. She created a local chapter, a black chapter for the American Red Cross. And she did all kinds of philanthropic work in the community. She was certainly a paragon of virtue and a shining example for children of all races.
I think it's important to go back for a second to Sarah Williams, Dr. Mm-hmm. Ella Piper's mother, who came here in 1899. And she was an important businesswoman and landowner. And she lived near what is today the U.S. 41 on-ramp to the Caloosahatchee Bridge. And what a lot of people need to know is that as you enter Fort Myers from that direction, you're in a traditionally black neighborhood called Pinetucky that until Jim Crow laws pushed blacks, you know, out of town to the Safety Hill and now Dunbar community. That was a thriving neighborhood, and it was a Fort Myers was a much more integrated place socially and in terms of commercial activity. And that's where Sarah Williams lived, owned land. She also worked for the Harvey Heitman family. And it was because her mother was here that Dr. Ella Piper came here later. And Williams started that party in 1915, I think. So I believe next year it will be 100 years old, that Christmas party.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Still going on. Yeah.
Wow. And there was, speaking of the whole issue of segregation here in the area, there was another woman who I know you had wanted to highlight, Jerry, who was the first black member of the White Methodist Church here.
Oh, yeah. I just wrote about her, so she's fresh in my mind. Mamie Jane Hendry, who was given in 1865 to the William Marion Hendry family. She came here with a family, and William Marion Hendry was a prominent family here. He was the brother of F.A. Hendry, who's called the father of Fort Myers. And she, even after slavery ended, and this was the case with many slaves, they remained with families as what were called faithful servants, to use one euphemism. Mm. They stayed with the family. In her case, she did, and she was a community activist. The William Marion Hendry was very active in starting and developing the what became the First Methodist Church, which is right downtown Fort Myers. And she was the only black member. She is also buried in the Frierson Hendry Cemetery, family cemetery on Henderson Avenue, with that family. Mamie Jane is. Another slave who parallels that was Aunt Clary, who was in the Henderson family. She remained with the family, worked for them, and her son even worked in the Henderson family store.
Oh, wow.
So there's a whole layer of an important group who are a vital part of the commercial life of Fort Myers, very early days.
Yeah. It's interesting the way the whole racial relationship has evolved from slave and slave owner to, as you said, that euphemism, faithful servant. And then there was a period, as you say, where there was more integration we know historically Fort Myers has been a very integrated has been very segregated for a long time, and we still see that reflected today in those communities. Woody Hanson, I wanted to turn to you now. We were on the subject of churches a little bit before, and I know your great-great-grandmother actually started the first Sunday school in the area, among other things. Tell us about her.
That's Julia Allen Hanson. Came to Fort Myers with her husband, Dr. William Hanson, in 1884. And she, along with Olive Stout, played a key role in starting churches, church, and that was the St. Luke's Episcopal Church on Cleveland Avenue to this day, and first Sunday school class, and along with other projects at the hospital and the women's club and so forth. What interesting story was, I learned recently, the first altar for the church was constructed from the wood that came from the cargo ship that the Hansons brought over when they came from Liverpool in 1880 through the Port of Philadelphia. So that was how much it meant to them.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, they did come from Liverpool, and Julia Allen, you mentioned to me, had quite a few pretty notable associations over in England. Tell us about some of the folks she was acquainted with.
Sure. Yeah. And Liverpool was the port that came out of them. They were
From London.
Yeah, Essex in England. And Julia had acquaintances with Charles Dickens, Lord Tennyson, Prince Albert. And others, Florence Nightingale. She was a blue blood. Her father was an architect to design the classical facade of the London Bridge, and her brother is noted for being one of the leading scientists that helped develop the whole organic chemistry paradigm.
And I understand, if I understand correctly, rather, Dr. Hanson and his wife, Julia, your great-great-grandparents actually started, what is now the Hanson Family Archives.
Yeah, sure did. If it wasn't for Julia Hanson, it's really all about the women and much, I think, this and downtown, everything else. And it's about my mother, Mary Ellen Gonzalez Hanson. And these series of women kept these documents. So, for example, when Jerry was talking, we have photographs in this collection of several of the people she was speaking of. I have original documents where my great-grandmother had written about the history of Lee County, history of Fort Myers, as she took notes from Captain F.A. Hendry. So it's kind of, primary source data. It's very interesting that way.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Mentioning Julia, for instance, I think it's important to mention, too, that today we enjoy a very thriving arts and culture community here in Fort Myers. I think for a town this size, it's notable. And people like Julia Hanson have a lot to do with it. When you read old accounts of what's going on in the women's club meetings, for instance, in the late 19th century, they're talking about women's rights. They're talking about natural history. They're talking about conservation laws. They're talking about a lot of the same things that we're talking about today, and those weren't necessarily the same things men were talking about around the general store. So we owe a lot to them that we have art galleries and so on today.
Yeah, interestingly, at the same time that the Fort Myers Women's Club were conversing about those types of topics, music and art and even social matters. Remember, this is 20 years before women got the franchise and were able to hold office. But it was women like Olive Stout and Flossie Hill that formed that women's club and pioneered those discussions. But at the same time that was happening, the men's contribution was they were forming a Sandlot Baseball League.
Mm-hmm. Interesting point to make there. Yeah. Woody Hanson, just tell us a little bit more about the Hanson family archives here. I know that a great deal of the photographs or the documentation is of the Mississippi and the Seminole Indians.
True. My grandfather was known as the White Medicine Man, and he was a trusted ally with the Seminole Miccosukee Indians. So the archives are heavily weighted towards photographs, other information pertaining with Flores Indians, census data, drawings by children, correspondence between Josie Billy, a medicine man, and my grandfather, and so forth. And it's really interesting how this bridges between turn of the century and even now. I was at the reservation, Seminole Reservation, the Big Cypress, not recently, and I handed a gentleman a notebook from my grandfather where he had written down a description of the dances that he had observed at the Green Corn Dance. And this fellow looked up at me, he's a Miccosukee Indian, and he just kept looking at me, and he said, "You don't know who I am, and you don't have any reason to, but you just gave my people back a dance that we lost many, many years ago." And and from then on, the Hanson family archives are kind of a different thing for me. It was real time and living, and it wasn't so much he was cataloging the history of the Indians. It was almost like he was keeping a guidebook for the Indians, for later times, such as now, so they can reflect on their traditional ways of life.
Wow, that's a great story. I wanted to have you tell us a bit about Susie Billy, the Mississippi Indian woman. She one of the photos you sent me is actually one of the ones on our website now. If you go to wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live, you can see a picture of Susie Billy. But tell us about her and her contributions.
Sure. She's a Mississippi healer in the Mississippi tribe, and as well as Seminole. The women cannot be medicine men, and the medicine men have to be members of the Panther clan. The women can be healers, but that's pretty much where it stops. And she was recognized for her ability as a healer, which means that she was very familiar with the broad range of species of plants and other matters in the Everglades and Big Cypress and how to use them to help her people.
And I understand also from our brief conversation earlier that, maybe not one woman in particular, but that when it came to the Mississippi and Seminole tribes, that the women played a big role in providing innovation and allowing the tribes to survive.
Well, absolutely. The Seminole Miccosukees are based upon a matrilineal clan system. So you have numerous clans, and each clan, the oldest or the elder woman runs a camp, runs a clan. And if you were to have a child with a woman that's a member of one clan, her brother would raise her child. Mm-hmm. But, pretty much, I was telling a friend the other day, I said, it's all about the women. The women are the ones that save the tribe during periods of challenges by developing patchwork that could be sold on the Tamiami Trail and so forth.
Hmm. And tell us a bit about Betty Mae Jumper. She was the first and only woman, you told me, to have chaired the Seminole Tribe of Florida Incorporated. What was so significant about her election to that leadership role?
I think one of the significant things is, number one, she's a woman. And since her term in that leadership position has been all men. So it helped her and it helped the tribe in that she established the vision. She became the vision leader for the tribe, and she has an interesting background in terms of her education and so forth, and she was one of the great vision leaders of the tribe.
And Tom, you wanted to jump in here?
Well, I don't want the morning to pass without us at least tipping our hat to who I consider to be probably the most influential pioneering woman of our community, and that was Tootie McGregor Terry. There's a fountain that's dedicated to her It's called the Tootie McGregor Fountain. It's out at the Fort Myers Country Club. It is celebrating its centenary. It's 100 years old. She died about 101 years ago. But Tootie McGregor Terry probably did more from 1906 to 1912 to develop Fort Myers than anyone else, man or woman. She was instrumental, for example, not only in financing Harvey Heitman and several of his projects. It was her who came up with the idea of putting in the seawalls and extending the riverfront from its original location at Bay Street to about 200 feet offshore. She filled all of that in from probably Monroe all the way out to Billy's Creek. Wow. She was instrumental because of her ownership of the Royal Palm Hotel in attracting many celebrities and millionaires to Fort Myers, many of whom made their winter homes here. She brought golf to the community, and she donated with her husband, Marshall Terry, 40 acres that were used for the spring training facility of Philadelphia Athletics, which brought spring training to Fort Myers. That was a very big deal.
Yeah.
And probably her biggest achievement is she was the one who was responsible for getting the roads in Fort Myers paved at that time. She came to the city and the county and said, look, I'll make you a deal you can't refuse. If you pave the road from Whiskey Creek to Monroe, I will personally pay to pave the road from Whiskey Creek out to Ponderosa, where the causeway is now to Sanibel. And she paid for that out of her own pocket, including putting in the bridges and culverts. And because of that road-building effort, that's what prompted the city to finally get around to asphalting the roads in downtown Fort Myers. Previous to that, they were sand, dirt, and weeds.
Yeah. I think an interesting tag on to that, she was such a strong woman and such a dedicated believer in Fort Myers. And as a wife, even after her death in 1912, I believe, Dr. Terry, out of love and respect for her, continued those projects, the road to Ponderosa, just in honor of her and tribute to the citizens of Fort Myers.
And what was really significant with Tootie is she didn't have to stay in Fort Myers. Her husband, Ambrose, was the 10th wealthiest man in the United States. So when he died in 1900, she could have moved anywhere. She could have moved back to Cleveland. She could have moved to New York, anywhere. And especially when she lost her son, Bradford, 2 years later, there was nothing to hold her here except for her love of the community. But because of that love, she not only decided to stay, she took a proactive role in helping Fort Myers develop from a cow town into a modern city.
Wow. Wow. Jerry, you wanted to say something?
I feel it's important, before our time ends, just to pitch in a couple of other names, because there were women who didn't have the means that people like Tootie McGregor had, or prominent families,
sure,
and yet did significant work over a period of time that we need to recognize, or maybe even did one single thing that really makes them a star, in my opinion. People like LaVita Allen, who in the 1920s, in the first Lee Memorial Hospital that was on Victoria and Grand, intentionally got fired because she treated a woman, a black woman, who was going to die if she didn't get treatment. And she knew that if she treated her, that she would lose her job as superintendent, and went ahead and did it. People like Carolyn Barton Smith, who in her early 20s was flying planes out of Buckingham all over the southeastern United States, and even repairing planes, doing remarkable things, real can-do, intelligent women who are representative of so many women that go unnoticed in the history books.
What about Carolyn Smith's aunt, Nell Barton?
Oh, yeah. Her aunt was the first woman in the late 1920s to be elected to office in Fort Myers. So she was treasurer and, city clerk. And in fact, that family seemed like a real can-do kind of family. And I met the niece of Carolyn Barton Smith, and she just sounded very remarkable. But again, you don't tend to hear about her.
Yeah. And what about Florence Fritz?
She was
elected mayor, but there was a recall?
Yeah, I think the very next year she was recalled. She's interesting. She came here, I think, around 1930. She was a social activist. She was a writer. She wrote some really good history books about the area. But she was elected mayor. And I've never gotten a complete story on exactly why she was recalled, but she was very controversial. I think she was maybe a little too progressive for the times, but she nevertheless went on, started a publication in Fort Myers called Hello Strangers during World War II that continued into the 50s, which was what's going on in Fort Myers? It had everything from radio listings to social events to parties to what's happening at the Hall of 50 States, which was the Civic Center then. She was also a early president of the Southwest Florida Historical Society, one of my favorite organizations. But she was a remarkable woman. And again, she's one who's sort of overlooked in the history books.
Yeah, and just one other thing that's following on what Tom said. These women saw the vision and they realized, what Fort Myers was and what it could be. And the one that comes to mind for me is the wife and widow of Andrew Gwynn, because he'd passed away and he'd made a promise to the people of Fort Myers that he would match whatever funds they raised to help build the school, which we now know as the Andrew Gwynn Institute. And after he died, she saw to it that they would keep the promise. And that's what my tagline for the day is, the women keep the promise. They kept the promise.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to take us back to those Fort Myers cattle days for a minute here with a look at Jane Hendry. Do you think that Captain Hendry would have moved to Fort Myers and helped transform it into the cow town it became if Jane hadn't made the move first?
I think it's highly unlikely. What had happened is Jane unfortunately lost her 6-year-old daughter to a bad fever. And at the time, she and her husband Charles were living in a two-room shack out near Immokalee, 30 miles from where the settlers were in Fort Myers. And she looked at her husband and she said, "I'm not living another day in the wilderness. If one of my other kids gets sick, I'm going to have help." And she moved to Fort Myers. And F.A. and his brother Marion were there when she died. They helped construct the casket for the poor little girl. They helped dig the grave. They saw the effect that had on Jane L. And I think it made a deep impression on Captain Hendry. Of course, I haven't read anything that tells me what his reaction was, but it must have made a pretty deep impression because about 2 months after Charles and Jane L. moved to Fort Myers, Marion and Captain F.A. moved their families in as well. And then several other Hendrys followed suit. And but for that, it's conceivable that Fort Myers could have been deserted. Yeah. The year before, the original settlers, Manuel Gonzalez, John Weatherford, two other settlers, all moved out in order to homestead property under the Homestead Act. It only left Joe Vivas and his wife Christiana in town. It's conceivable that F.A. and hadn't followed Jane L. into town, there might not have ever been a Fort Myers. And that's why I say it's not hyperbolic to say that. Yeah. But for our founding females, there may not be a Fort Myers today.
Yeah. You brought up the Gonzalez family, the first settlers in the area. And Woody Hanson, someone you have blood ties to as well. Is that correct?
That's correct. My great-great-grandfather is Manuel A. Gonzalez. He and his wife, Elizabeth Weatherford, who is from the Man O' War in the Bahamas, came to Fort Myers as permanent settlers to the officers' quarters in the old fort in 1866 in February.
Wow. So, you're talking about Jane Hendry not wanting to live in the wilderness. These folks really didn't have an option. There was probably nothing but wilderness back here then. Interesting. Jerry?
Oh,
I thought you wanted to add something there. No.
Tipping my hat to the Gonzalez's. What a remarkable story theirs was, because when Manuel Gonzalez was a schooner captain, he used to bring mail and supplies to the fort that was built here in the 1850s for the Seminole Wars. And he remembered the fort in its heyday. He remembered how beautiful it was. Mm. And when he sailed up the river in 1866, by then the fort had been picked over by Confederate soldiers that were returning to Tampa and Cedar Key and needed to rebuild their plantations. They picked over the fort. There was nothing but a skeleton. And that notwithstanding, Manuel Gonzalez, Weatherford, Joe Vivas decided to stay. And that decision was instrumental in the development of our town.
And it's interesting too, because Emmanuel Gonzalez, even before 1866, just like Tom said, he was running the mail between Tampa and the fort, and other things. And he had opened up an outpost on the river to trade with the Indians. And so when I'm asked all these questions, as I am about the Indians, I say, well, the Gonzaleses were involved with the Indians 18 to 20 years before the Hansons ever got here. Mm. So, you know, so you got to give them credit. And then, you know, and just putting a small plug in for Chad Gillis and Andrew West for this article they just published this week in Voice of the Everglades. You got to read it. It's unbelievable.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Jerry, I wanted to ask you, you know, having written two books on local history, what is it that sparked your interest in the history of this area or that's maintained that?
When I come to a new place, I like to feel placed. And the way I do that is I look around. I notice what, you know, the ecosystem, the plants, the natural history, the geography, the feel, the air. Mm-hmm. For instance, there's a big difference between Fort Myers and Miami that mm-hmm. if you notice, you know, you can feel it in the air, you can see it in the light. And that leads, of course, to checking out the people. I'm actually more interested in place than I am in people. But my first book, therefore, focused on place, the Then and Now book from Arcadia. I love mapping where I live in my head. I carry all these maps, you know, layers of time. And with my second book, I got to fill in a lot of the places with the people who've impacted the places for good or bad.
I can share with what Jerry's saying because after learning about all of the historical places and the people that made those places, my enjoyment of downtown Fort Myers is greatly enhanced. Sure. There's a world of difference between just walking down a street and seeing some old buildings and then knowing the story of those buildings and the people that made them. And that's why I love sharing that experience with the folks that take tours with True Tours because we get to share that experience. And pretty much everyone who takes one of those tours comes away with that same feeling. It's all of a sudden they see Fort Myers in a different light.
And I think this is what's really great about Fort Myers and what's going on now, what Tom and Jerry and the work they're doing and how important it is, contribution. As I listen to Jerry, I think of a term like, well, she's a spatial historian, like GIS, mm-hmm. spatial economics or whatever. And Tom, I see his groups downtown pointing at, architectural features, cornices on buildings. And I walk by and I hear him, and it's fantastic. Because for somebody like myself who was born here, I'm in 1954, I'll be 60 in August. These things are ubiquitous. They were just part of the day-to-day life. I mean, I went to the Edison home so early, I don't know. But after that, it was just I drive down McGregor and I didn't even see it.
Right.
So it's great that these wonderful people come back and bring that to my attention.
Excellent.
And now we look at Woody and we consider him to be a cultural asset and resource.
Absolutely. We certainly do here. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, unfortunately. And I still had a whole list of women we could have gone and talked about. But unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Tom Hall. He writes for TheExaminer.com and leads the Fort Myers Founding Females Historical Walking Tour of downtown Fort Myers through True Tours. Tom, thanks so much for coming back.
It was totally my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Also, thanks to author and columnist with the River Weekly News, Jerry Reeves. Really appreciated having you back in studio.
Oh, thank you.
And lastly, thank you to fifth-generation Fort Myers resident and keeper of the Hanson Family Archives, Woody Hanson.
Thank you very much.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, members of our political analysis team take a second look at the special election race for Florida's 19th congressional district seat. That race has been heating up since our last conversation. That segment's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.